along the flooded broken mansions. I did all my best to see her laugh from playful passion, where once gorgeous phantoms glide. Sometimes I used to fly away at night on the wings of an old love song. Somehow I used to feel that I was weak and I grew strong. And the funny thing was that I called your name. You called my name. Tilled out among those roads like provincial sun. Will we be strong enough to carry on? The memory flickered, but the fragrance, yes, the fragrance, the fragrance remains insane.
Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the Made in Scotland 80s podcast. My name's Dougie, and as you can tell by that intro, it's one of the most distinguishable voices that we have in Scotland. Today we are talking to Mr. Chris Thompson from The Bathers. Oh, really excited about this one. Initially I thought it was going to be one episode, but I think it's going to be a minimum of two, possibly three. We spoke about so much that covered Friends Again from Chris's early days. We covered the first couple of albums by The Bathers, which was Unusual Places to Die and Sweet Deceit. And we then had a chat about Bloomsday. So just have a listen, leave me your comments below and enjoy it. And we'll catch up with you at the end of it. Thank you. Chris, thank you very much.
Pleasure, Dougie. Nice to be here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm so excited that you agreed for this. I'm actually buzzing that, you know, I can sit and chat to you about it. So you're one of my kind of heroes, you know. So
well, it's no pressure then, but no, that's very kind of you to say. So it's a pleasure to be asked. Thank you.
And we've had a great response on social media. So I have some questions from the people that's been posting on Twitter to ask you later on as well, if that's okay.
Okay, absolutely. Brilliant.
If I could kick things off, Chris, if we could go back to the very start, from, like, you know, the Friends Again period, when you growing up in Uddingston, how you met the boys within the Friends Again, and how that gelled with the songwriting and the album Trapped and Unwrapped, which is going to be re-released as well as a double CD, and I think is Paul.
Paul did the mastering on it, pulled it all together, and it was actually a great thing that he was on board rather than someone who didn't know the stuff so well, because it was quite hard to identify, you know, what demo version was what, and, you know, just to marry it all up is when some of the tapes arrived, they were wrongly marked and what have you, but he was a first-hand witness of what had happened, so he could put all that to rights. So he basically kind of compiled it from all those master tapes, and then he'd put it through the mastering process at his own studio, and did a grand job on the, as you say, double CD that came out on Cherry Red Records.
Yep, that's right.
Seemed to do, you know, I think they very quickly had to do a repressing, so I think they were surprised, and so were we, that, you know, it was a really good reception. Uh-huh. The plan is very much hoping that we can get a vinyl edition out.
Great.
Next year sometime, that would be really nice to have it back on vinyl.
It would,
because I think it's an album that stands up, you know.
Even now, it's like, you know, the energy that's in that album as well, and it's all of you coming together, and it's a great album, and it's super that you've got the remixes amongst it as well, and the bonus tracks and stuff.
There's a lot of sort of wee hidden, you know, things that I've forgotten. Oh, that's actually really quite good. I think the very, very earliest demos, that, you know, they're just the quirkiness of them.
Yeah.
And as we were kind of emerging from a point where we were quite influenced, I think, by things like Joy Division, a bit darker. But then we crossed over when the postcard scene started happening in Glasgow, and it was sort of very, very, very early 80s, if not late 70s, we sort of started to be drawn towards that a bit more. And I think some of the very earliest demos kind of reflect that. There's a few things that, oh, that's quite dark. There's a Simple Minds Joy Division thing going on. Mm-hmm. And then guitars get progressively more jangly. And, you know, it was an interesting sort of melting point for us.
So how did you all meet? How did the band come about?
The Friends Again guys, well, it was the classic thing. I was at primary school with Paul McGeachan.
Yep.
And we local boys brigade, that sort of stuff. Then we were on to secondary, and somewhere in secondary school, part of the whole music lessons thing was the ones that weren't actually seriously taking music, the geeks with the wee violin cases.
Yeah.
the mass hordes like us lot were, you know, 30 people in a room, and it was the defaulted to bring your own record in Fridays or something like that. I don't know if you had a similar setup, but it was a bit of a, you know, it was a bit of a standoff between people, and I'm sure Paul was actually amongst that group where they'd be bringing in, you know, Pink Floyd or Zeppelin, right. ELP. Then there was a more punky wave that was part of the punky set who were bringing in Stiff Little Fingers, you know, things like that were big breakers, Undertones, Clash, Pistols. So I was really quite drawn to punk as well as Bowie, Iggy, Velvet Underground. Paul was coming from more, you know, the Floyd, some Beatles, the rockier progressive side of things. But we met somewhere in the middle. And another pal in that music class was Neil Cunningham, who went on to play bass in Friends Again.
Yep.
And Neil was a great, and still to this day is a great discoverer of all things music. You know, he was always one coming home with the, you know, the latest Talking Heads album or something, like the first Bunnyman. I remember the first time I'd heard of the Bunnyman, it was just,
right,
I was just bought this album, you know, check this out. So, you know, it was such a big thing, you know, at schools then, the whole culture around buying records. And I can't remember what prompted us to actually try and form a band. It's just that love of music, and someone who I think dropped out very quickly said, let's form a band. And it was kind of, as he gave voice to that thought, I realized it had been bubbling up inside me for a while. That was, I don't know, I was 15, I didn't play an instrument. I remember the rather tortuous experience of going to made the mistake of saying to my family that, oh yeah, we're forming a band. Oh, right. What do you mean you're forming, you don't play an instrument? I said, well, I've taken up guitar. All right, well, Aunt Joy, my dad's sister, Aunt Joy has a guitar. All right. And so, of course, I had that torturous thing going up to where they stayed in Stirling on a Sunday.
Uh-huh.
And Aunt Joy's guitar came out, and it was god-awful, going to out-of-tune Spanish guitar, which she couldn't play either. But, okay, play us something. I was like, oh, no. No cringe at the memory, but I was like, okay, I think I know My Love Can Tire. And there was rhythm with no harmonic content, you know, and it was just, but I think that was the spur. I actually went off and then started learning a little bit of guitar.
Yeah.
And we're a classic garage band. We're playing in the garage, trying to piece a few very rough things together. But from an early stage, I was trying to write some of my own songs merged in with some covers.
Right.
So we're covering everything, a bit of Clash, a bit of Bowie, Iggy, Future Days by, I don't know if you remember, Pretty Paracetamol. That was an early cover that we did. So that was a group, and that was, I think, the first riff that Paul learned on the keyboard.
Right.
Anyways, we sort of mono sent, you know, 100 quid from CC Music down the town. So we're kind of up and running. I mean, there's a lot of, like so many of the bands, I think there's so many false starts and things, you know, shambolic gigs, you know, ineptitudes writ large across the whole thing. But we kind of got there. We had the beginnings of some kind of vision that some basic songwriting ability and things like that.
So did you write all this most...
I think in that early phase I did. So Friends Again, we kept going over that couple of year period as punk emerged into new wave. postcard scene, and we at some point in all that we James Grant joined, who again was probably more from a sort of Americana tradition. It wasn't really at all fashionable. And I mean, Americana, the closest thing many of us were aware of was the kind of more the New York scene, the Velvets, New York Dolls, television,
right?
All that stuff. But James is coming in with the Eagles, you know, Little Feet. He was a Zeppelin fan as well. But the beauty of it was he'd sat in pretty much sat in his room for a couple of years in Castle Milk,
right?
Learning those. The musicality was high with James, and he always was. A fantastic player, great talent.
Yeah.
And so when he joined the band, it was a sort of quantum leap in terms of technical ability. And of course, we'd got to a certain stage, but that kind of turbocharged the thing to really, we all had to raise our game quite considerably.
Uh-huh.
And I'd already had some songs in the bag, but James came in and contributed. We started co-writing a bit. You know, I had an idea, and he would say, "Oh, I've got a bit of this," and we merged things.
Yeah.
And he had a few riffs kicking about. I can think of one off the hand was Sunkissed. He had the very distinct sort of funky riff. And I said, okay, and I played about, added things, we chopped and changed. Yeah, so for me being the main songwriter to begin with, James came on board. Paul always had great melodic ideas,
right?
And he started contributing as well. And I look back. I mean, to be fair, Neil Cunningham, the bass player, I listened to some of his bass lines on those early recordings, and I think, wow, you know, he was really inventive. There's a lot going on there that I'd forgotten at the time, and you know, that was writing in its own way, and there's always that distinction between writing the song, but when you're writing parts, and there's a lot of creativity across the band. And then of course we had a fantastic drummer who had the most extraordinary falsetto voice, Stuart Kerr.
Yeah, Stuart. Yeah,
joined him, it was really beautiful harmonies, but strangely he had a lot of power in his falsetto, which and of course James had a good voice, so we sort of quickly scaled up, you know, for the songwriting was there. And then more of us started writing together. And then the kind of musical palette really widened out.
All the talent kind of combined together.
It did, yeah. Yeah, we're very, very fortunate. So you don't really realize at the time, you're just struggling from what seems like one disaster to the next. But actually, when you measure it with hindsight, you realize, the progression was definitely there.
When you look back on it now, it's an album that does stand the test of time, you know, and I suppose you're right. Yeah. If you're in the mix of it and, you know, you're young guys at the same time as well.
Yeah.
You don't actually realize what you're creating till you take a step away from it.
No idea. Yeah. It was a massive step in the dark. I mean, I think we're very fortunate at the time. There was a lot of interest around Glasgow and Scottish music generally coming up from London. And it wasn't, at one point it would have seemed far-fetched to get a record deal, but then just suddenly something happened around about that. After Orange Juice, Aztec Camera and all the rest of it, there suddenly was an influx of A&R people coming up here and we benefited from that. You know, there was interest there. It was, I don't know, it seemed a bit sort of fanciful when the young guy that was managing, he was just our age, but he was a bit of a go-getter and went down to London and he was in the Camden Palace. He said, yeah, I went up and spoke to Boy George. I was speaking to the Spandau guys, and he had that kind of front that was talking it up. And they were, Looking back, probably half of what he told us was absolute poppycock. You know? Yeah, Boy George loves the demos. And, you know, like, did Boy George even hit? You know, but it was a good tactic because it got us all sort of vibed.
Yeah, well, that's
Gary Kemp wants to produce the single. Who knows?
do you have any...
Lie, but it was a good lie.
Do you have any favourite tracks from Trapped and Unwrapped?
Yeah. Well, I love the wee throwaway. There was a track called Moon 3. It might even be the closing track on the original album. I think it was conceived as a B-side. And it was just something kind of it was very much done in the studio. I wish we'd done more of that sort of thing.
So very, very cold, where you're calling from. I shake the laser, it's so very, very cold, where you're calling from. The laser, keep the pace. I can call you at your address, I can call you some mad girl's name, and say, Moosey has gone. Maybe it's better that way. Moon 3 has gone. Maybe it's better that way. Moon 3 has gone. And it could only pave the way to Moon 3 has gone.
James and I, we worked on the song a wee bit back at the flat we were staying in London, but basically it's working on during the day up to Rack Studios in St. John's Wood at night, and it just went down quickly, kind of pretty much one take, a couple of guitar overdubs. And in fact, at the end of the track, the tape runs out, so it kind of, it does a strange sound, but it's literally, it was however long the song is, 2 minutes or something. Just that amount of tape on the old 2-inch tapes, and it literally ran out of the, which seemed to be a lovely metaphor for the title Moon 3 came from the catalogue number of the State of Art single, which the record company, everyone told it was going to be this massive hit and all the rest of it. I never quite believed that, but you know, kind of, it was off, that there's a sort of pivotal point where that didn't burst into the charts. I think it scraped the top 50 or something. There was a kind of sense of the record company started to get a bit edgy.
Yeah.
And the album process was going on and on. So we kind of wrote that song in a bit of, kind of inspired by the frustration and nervousness and a little bit of anger about the whole thing. But it came off really well. So that's our favourite. It's a long way of saying that's our favourite track. When listen to State of Art now, I think, you know, it's a great, I think everyone involved did such a great job, and the playing and the production.
Yep.
It's particularly the 12-inch version of that song is a very lush.
Right.
Luckily, I've got a copy.
She's a work of art.
you get involved with Paul when it came to the remixing of the CDs here this time round? Were you involved?
Yeah, a wee bit. I kind of went out to Paul's studio and he'd run a few things past me and said, you know, I'm thinking of doing this and that, you know, that he just wanted a little bit of a second opinion on certain things.
Right.
And I gave a few suggestions on the running order and what to include. I think it was one of those you felt we may as well include as much as they can get on the CD because It's just pull some things out of the archive. It was the perfect opportunity.
Yep.
And there was a couple of demos. I thought, oh wow, I've forgotten that even existed, and it's actually, you know, something to be quite pleased with.
Did you feel any, you know, as Friends Again was gathering momentum and the Trapped and Unwrapped was coming out, did you feel drawn towards, you know, the inclination of what you are now as the Bathers? Did you have any kind of draw towards it back then, you know, on the genre of music?
Yeah, I think that was in there. It was quite buried. I think there was a tension within the band over direction, which, you know, I think totally understandably, a lot of the guy, James most of all, they had the ability to be a frontman and because of this frustration with lack of a commercial breakthrough with Friends Again, I think he wanted the validation of really having a serious big commercial hit, you know, and that was the driving force for them. And I always sort of instinctively shied away from it. You know, and often sort of think of the trajectory you'd be on if you had a fluke one-off single.
Yeah,
I'm thinking maybe more of Agate or something like that. Not that we were going to do something that cheesy, but you know, you could be sort of defined for the rest of your days by the Right Said Fred card or something. You know,
there was a lot of one-hit wonders in the 80s, wasn't there?
One-hit wonder syndrome. But I was always, you know, it's like the kind of, if you look at, say, something like Bowie, which was a big influence to many of us in that classic mid to late 70s period.
Yep.
The stuff that really excited me was the low heroes. You know, when I heard Warsaw and John Peel's instrumental, then A Strange Phonetic Language comes in. Uh-huh. It wasn't Let's Dance period Bowie. So that kind of, in a way, formed what appealed to me. And in a way, that seed was there to try and do, to answer your question, that's what drew me towards the direction the Bather stuff went into some degree. Uh-huh. I was more interested in a darker, not as obvious to commercial as, and so that was there. And I think even though it was difficult that the Friends Again thing imploding as it did, it was a good thing for all of us creatively in the longer run.
Yeah, so that's, you know, that some kinds of relationships, it gives you that taste, and then you know what direction you've gone ahead in. So did Friends Again, did it disband, was it 84? Was it 84?
Yeah, it was very much. I remember this time in 84. I think we had some tour dates to fulfill. So we actually played a few shows, even though we'd broken up, which was a little bit uncomfortable.
Right.
But part of the reason being that, famously or infamously, we'd finally been booked to do The Tube. Which was, you know, you probably admit that was the big deal.
Yeah, it was. Yep.
The record company had spent about a year. Yeah, we've almost got him. The big shot producer, John, somebody that booked everyone. It was his baby. And they were always, the promo guy, the record company was always working on it. And I think I've got him. I think we're on this time. And he's not quite there yet. He's not quite there. But then the story came back that this producer guy had sat down with a bottle of red, you know. In Easter times, you could say, put the album on and I love it, right, book them. So you're on, you're booked for The Tube.
Right.
And then unfortunately, you know, James dropped the bombshell that he wanted to leave, but it was breaking the band up.
Yeah, yeah.
So we sort of conspiratorially said, hey, why don't we just keep it under wraps, do The Tube as a farewell, which makes perfect sense, except we didn't share this scheme with the manager, who was pretty much our age. In fact, he's now Paul's brother-in-law, and but he got wind because we handled it so badly. We didn't just be up front with him and say, look, this makes sense to do it. So he kind of blew up that we hadn't just said, you know, we've broken up. And so next day it all exploded. They went back to the record company and the plug was pulled and the whole thing. So
right.
It was kind of classic Youthful Folly, the way it ended. Mm-hmm. But yes, so I remember it well. It was October 84. I think that the final gig was at Bell College, as it was then.
Oh, right. Hamilton. Yeah.
Actually, right. Not that far from your neck of the woods, somewhere between our neck of the woods. I think it's a university status now or something, but yeah.
I think it is, yeah.
So that was it. That was game over. Yeah.
But it was the experience that you... It was the experience you all needed to have, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, once you've kind of got your foot in the door and had... I suppose it was a sort of naive expectation that, you know, you'd had one record deal that you could continue and get others. But as it turned out... We did get independently got other deals. I mean, the Love and Money guys went on and stayed with Phonogram for a number of albums and years, and that,
yep.
You know, almost cracked through to that big commercial breakthrough. And I was fortunate enough to sort of stumble through various mechanisms into various other record contracts. In fact, last night my first gig, not as a player, I played last weekend. But as a punter, I was at the Barrowlands last night for the Billy Bragg show.
Right.
It was my first big, you know, 2,000 people, a bit different. And I thought, well, Billy Bragg, good God, he was a label mate back in the day at Go Discs.
Oh, so he was
the big cheese because he'd had that massive, the first album was a, you know, recording in a bedroom or something. It was a big breakout hit, you know. And so I met Billy a few times, incredibly supportive down at the label. I get, you know, things, the politics of the record company didn't necessarily work out, but it meant that we, you know, got that first Bathers album up and away.
Yep. So that was Unusual Places to Die, wasn't it?
The first, that's right, yeah.
Bathers album, that was the 87 with Go Discs.
Yeah, it's a bit blurry because I think I probably recorded along with 86.
Mulatto gifted with you. Disappear, be something new. Oh, here's some place to go. 1,000 night will be one day. Tell me you believe it. The baggage overload. Drive through heaven's gate and see her again, walking in the acid rain. But isn't she shining so bright? Yes, isn't she shining tonight? Lead me into your life. Can you kneel, be a sweet bird again? Lead me into
the naive notion that you know, I could more or less not snap my fingers, you know, not that degree of arrogant confidence, but I certainly felt confident that I could get a deal and place it. But I had in my mind, we worked a lot in a brilliant studio in Edinburgh called Palladium. It was great, the Cocteaus and everyone, and we'd done a lot of Friends Again stuff. I did the first two Bathers albums there. In fact, I think I did the first four. But that studio had quite a relationship with 4AD Records, Ivor Watts Russell. So I think John Turner, who ran the studio, probably said to me, "Oh yeah, Ivor will come in and do the album. Yeah, Ivor will love this. Ivor will do it." So I thought, I had a bit of publishing money from the Friends Again days. You know, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 quid or something. So I thought, right, basically paid for the album up front. Uh-huh. And then when the time came, as I got quite progressively through, I thought, this is sounding great. And John Turner gave me Ivo Watts Russell's phone number. So I phoned this guy, you know, out of the blue, and I'm working in Palladium. And it very quickly became apparent in the conversation that there was no way, he couldn't physically countenance releasing any new music or even booking it in. So he said, it doesn't matter if your record is the best album I have ever heard. Right, we physically cannot handle signing anyone else right now for at least another year. So it was like, oh, that kind of took the wind from the sails. So I was like, 5-6 grand down or whatever. But I did have an album I really believed in. And that at that point, there's an old Friends Again fan called Don Bartlett, who I think went on to have a career in PR. She was obviously good at it, but she, as a sort of fan friend, said, look, come down to London, I'll do the rounds. So she did a bit of footwork, went around a few labels in London, one of them being Go Discs, who were down in Shepherd's Bush at that time.
Yeah.
And took it in, and they liked the demos. They were like, yeah, bring this guy in. So the next week I was down in London, and Dawn and I went up to Go Mansions, as it was called, just a wee kind of place in Shepherd's Bush. And they signed it. It did suddenly move very quickly from, yeah, we love it, we want to sign this. So, you know, I did stumble into that other deal. Fortunately, again, down having someone who could just front it up and really help me out, because I didn't have that kind of, that certain confidence you get to go in and just, you know, basically demand a deal, whatever.
Were you producing your own albums as well at this time?
I think Friends Again were accredited a lot with co-production work, because we're in and out of that studio so much, and we produced all our own demos, and it was a bit of an ideas fest, if I can put it that way. That there was a lot of, you know, James would always have about when two great ideas would do, he'd have six. I mean, he was that sort of prodigiously turning out this stuff. Uh-huh. So we all had ideas, we were kind of competing, but it was a good, really great training ground to learn, you know, a bit of studio technique and just how to make ideas work in a studio. And so by the time I did the first Bathers record, I was able to kind of co-produce it with John Turner, and I worked a lot with the resident engineer there, Keith Mitchell. It was just a lot of fun, even though the albums were sometimes quite dark in places. It was quite, as often you hear from these situations, it was a bit of a hoot actually making it, you know. I loved it. It was home residential studio out on, at that time, what was the very edge of Edinburgh, and you know, out near where the IKEA is now, apparently over the wall. So changed days, but then it felt like you're out in the country in the very edge of town. Uh-huh. It was very nice setup.
Is there any tracks on the Unusual Places to Die album that you are pretty fond of now, and that you would perform in your own shows, you know?
Yeah, like, well, the first gig in front of a live audience, we did a set in Aberdour last weekend, and included a song, well, a version of a song that is called Isn't She Shining. We did something more based on the original demo, which was called The Mandarins, but it's recognisably the same song, and it was great. Yeah, great to do it. You know, very fond of a few. I think that the first album stands up well.
Yeah, it does.
In fact, it's slated for re-release on vinyl, and it'd probably be early next year by the time they get the copies through. But that's brilliant to have it back out there.
Uh-huh. You know, it's going to fly off the shelf.
That's well, I hope so.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's just been a kind of, because it's been out of circulation for so long. I don't. It's not even available on Spotify and all the rest of it.
Right. I'm sure it's, you know, there's like an army of fans out there. Like the minute your material comes out, it's a rush to buy it. You know, everybody's rushing to get it because it's.
Well, it's, I hope so.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, it's a funny thing how you measure any sort of success in terms of how many units you're shifting and all that. Because I mean, you know, it's a bit of a fool's game. I always feel a bit sad when something, there's something a bit naff about things that get ridiculously big, like the Mamma Mia DVD, where like every second house in the country has it. It's like, there's a point where that kind of success isn't really that appealing, you know, and I don't think I was ever in a chance of that. But, you know, I mean, it's just night. It doesn't really matter if it's 500 vinyl albums or it's kind of the fact that anyone's out there listening and enjoying your music. You don't know the trajectory. We live in a world where there's so many means of accessing music, and that's just great if you're part of it. It doesn't, it's nice not really to have to worry about what's selling, what's the chart position this week. It's just, it's the music for its own sake, you know, it's the art for art's sake and all the rest of
for
it.
What,
So
you went from Unusual Places to Die, Chris, and then it was Sweet Deceit was your next album.
Things went belly up.
You changed record labels then?
Exactly, and it's enforced. There was a massive, as I mentioned earlier, you know, Billy Bragg was on the label. He was the big head. You know, he was the big guy. He basically funded the explosion of the label. They went from very modest, often Shepherd Bush, down to Hammersmith, swanky new offices, pretty much off the back of Billy, and the House Martins, of course, exploded at that time, and they were on the label.
Yeah.
But unfortunately for me, the Go Discs as a label identity had a sort of a background deal with Chrysalis Records. Mm-hmm. And for reasons unbeknownst to me, kind of political things were happening. Andy McDonald, who ran the label with his wife, Juliet, who's now Billy's wife, which I don't know how that all came to be, but yeah, there was a connection from way back. They ran the label. They decided to what seemed like a moonlight flit from Chrysalis over to whoever it was, some other big, I don't know, it was PolyGram or something, took over the background role, and Chrysalis were mightily cheesed off. And unfortunately, it was just as my album was set to come out, The Bathers' first album, and it was caught, absolutely caught in that gap. So Chrysalis were saying, we've got this album. They really seem to like it, and they're like, we want to get behind this, but what's happening here? Go Discs have disappeared. It's technically a Go Discs album, but it was just an absolute mess.
Right.
But I remember Billy, amongst others, stepping forward saying, I'll try and sort this out. It was very supportive. But the end result was there was no way to work out because Chrysalis felt they owned it. And Go Discs, it was easier for them to completely walk away and start their own thing. So we sort of lurched on for a few months. But when the second single was scheduled for release, but it didn't even come out because I think enough time had passed that the record company had to pick up an option or let me go, and they just, rather than forking out more cash, they just let me go, and that led me into the Sweet Deceit phase, which again, no deal, and I invested what money I had in making the Sweet Deceit record. And I
followed you one night from the Glasgow School of Art. We took a night train, Paris and trams. We took a room off the Rue Royale. Played you some tunes you seem to like rather well. Parade. I swam around at your feet, like some sweet lemonade. By the window in the moonlight, I unbuttoned your dress, drank the sweet honey of your lips, and was filled by your sweet caress. Later on in the nighttime, on the glistening streets, I put you in a taxi and kissed your cheek. Someday I might forget myself. One day I might forget myself, but I could never forget the softness of your cheek. The softness of your cheek. Do I believe in you? Do I believe in myself? I don't know, but I believe in love.
I think it was a good way of doing it, looking back, because it was kind of my own cash, my own risk. I could do what the hell I wanted. And of all the record, certainly that one did go down that, something you alluded to earlier about being drawn to this sort of, you know, away from the more commercial popular side of things that Friends, yep, again might run. The Sweet Seat certainly was a kind of challenging record to listen to. I think it was a really great set of songs, actually, but for some reason I wanted to really kind of push the limits of where my voice could go. It's quite a,
because your voice changes, you can, you know, you can see it, you can hear it develop from Unusual Places to Die, Grand Sweet Deceit, becoming more your unique style.
Yeah, so it was a change of style. I mean, I'm actually struck thinking about it that there may have been an element in it was driving me, that the same thing that drove James in Love and Money. I remember when the Candy Bar Express came out, it was a kind of two fingers to, I think James particularly felt, Friends Again were often sort of dismissed as old jangly pop, whimsical. There was always kind of words. There was a sort of point where the postcard bands became sort of unfashionable, and we were in that, we were sort of categorized within that somehow, and it really got to James. All of us a bit cheesed off. So you go through the trajectory of getting the great reviews on the, you know, the Honey at the Core, the first single come out, it was all, you know, cool new indie kids on the block. Mm-hmm. 18 months down the line, I think a lot of the stuff is, the album itself, I think, was pretty coolly received. Even a single like State of Art, which you listen to now, you're thinking, well, that's really that's a pretty amazing record for a bunch of 20-something guys to make. Yep. You know, so it's quite great. But it wasn't heralded as such then. But I think, my James's reaction was kind of where he says, right, I'm going for the commercial jugular, we're going to, you know, this is going to tear paint off the walls type of music. I think my reaction was that's a Sweet to See approach, sort of, you know, stuff you, you know, it was, I'm just going to make this in my own terms. And you know, it worked. It's an album that I think it works. I'm proud of the record, but it certainly was a kind of anti-commercial kind of, it was not an easy listening experience.
It was a difficult time though in Scotland as well. It's 1990. We were going through so much.
Absolutely. I remember that I'd been making it in the late 80s. I think it came out in 1990.
Yeah.
You know, again, you start to think, well, I've had two deals, you know, is there anyone going to be interested in this thing? Mm-hmm. And I think I probably only started to feel like that towards the end of it, when I actually had the hot potato of an album to, what's the outlet for that? And of course, there weren't as many choices then as, you know, the whole digital revolution that didn't exist. I mean, you potentially got an indie, small indie. I was like, okay, what's going to happen? And fortunately, again, luck was on my side. I was approached somewhere towards the end of making that, the Sweet Deceit record, by the two former Lloyd Cole and the Commotions players, Neil Clark and Stephen Irvin.
Yep.
after Lloyd had split up the Commotions, they were looking for a new project, and someone had said, well, why don't you speak to Chris about it? And I kind of had spoken to them. You know, we emerged from the same scene, and the Commotions went supernova very quickly, which is, you know, well-deserved. That first album is amazing.
It is, aye.
And so I'd kind of met them in passing in the Rock Garden or something in town. And I probably knew Lloyd better than Neil, you know. But anyway, they approached me, said, look, we're trying to get something going. And as I finished the Sweet Deceit thing, we did demos as Bloomsday.
Oh, it's nice to feel the rain on your face. You're with a girl in a fortune cape of innocence. You're the language of love. Use the language of love. Watch your platter here with Chinese coons. Through her hair you let your fingers roam. Laugh so much you couldn't make the stairs. What you fell in there was me on despair. Felt the language of love. You felt the language of love. There's something of you in everything I do. I fall from your eaves soon. Excuse me, please. Widely claim
Island Records very quickly snapped us up, and as that was ongoing, I started to think, if I sign an exclusive recording deal, what about Sweet Deceit? So I had to kind of say, hands up, I'm actually working on something. Can I? What kind of guarantees are there for me? Uh-huh. Fortunately, the guy called Clive Banks, who was a publisher stroke running Island Records as the chief executive or whatever they called it, he phoned me, and I'm absolutely certain. I think he was listening as he phoned, but it was just a realpolitik thing for him.
Right.
He had this potential problem of, right, I want to sign Bloomsday. I've got this weird kind of sounding album. It's not, you know, he was very much kind of velvet tour jackets and Dash logos and all that kind of stuff. So I'm convinced that he would not have got the Sweet Deceit record in his bag. But anyway, the reality was he just said, okay, yeah. Oh, okay, what's this cost you? And so I was able to not only recoup my money, but I got a bit on top and get the record released through Island. It was like, so suddenly it was a golden scenario from being a slightly thin ice moment. It found a fitting home. And we got, you know, and it, ironically outperformed the Bloomsday record commercially. I mean, it did. I think they were surprised at how well it did. You know, particularly in I think Scotland and Germany, it was a big record. You know, and it stormed the charts. But you know, it was all relative.
The guy, hi.
And we went on to do the Bloomsday thing for off the back of it, and it was a bit of an overhang. I think there was a few things that were leftover lyrics and things that I was able to channel into the Bloomsday record. The show kept rolling on.
I've got a question for on Bloomsday that one of the 12 users, but I'll keep it for the end.
Keep it back. Okay, cool.
I'll keep it for the end. Just try to run you about the place.
Turn to who can you trust? Cool.
something? Ain't that something? Why he? Why please? You bloom, care for me. Fireplace, you bloom, ain't that something? You bloom, care for me, make me feel so good.
Well, folks, that's where we have to leave episode one. I really enjoyed that. That was such a treat to sit with Chris and go through the Friends Again stuff and the early Breathers material. And then just there at the latter end of it, some Bloomsday stuff. So we're going to pause that story there and we'll pick it up in episode two, where we kick things off with the Marina work that Chris done. And we'll be reviewing the albums and having a chat with Chris about the songs and his whole journey from Marina right up to where we are today. So thank you very much for listening. Please leave your comments below and we'll see you in the next episode. Thank you.